The state of higher education is tumultuous. Not a single week goes by without some story of political activism, unjust cancellation, campus protest, etc. hitting the news. Our universities really don't have to be like this. Rolston College aims to reshape this landscape. Alongside its MA in the humanities, Rolston is launching a summer school teaching Latin in Sicily, Rome and other sites. The program, running from July to September, offers immersive language learning with experts, literary reading, seminars and even archaeological visits. Most importantly, this course is designed for people who have never studied Latin. Anyone in the world can apply, and the strongest applicants will be awarded full scholarships that cover the cost of the entire program. Apply by the 31st of May at rolston.ac/Latin-program.
Hello and welcome to Trigonometry. I'm Francis Foster.
I'm Constantine Kitten.
And this is a show for you if you're bored with people arguing on the internet over subjects they know nothing about. At Trigonometry, we don't pretend to be the experts, we ask the experts.
Our fantastic guest this week is a former Conservative MP and a columnist for The Times here in London, Matthew Paris. Welcome to Trigonometry.
Hello.
It is so good to have you here. Let's get straight into it. Normally we get the guests to tell us a little bit about themselves, but I think most people will know who you are.
It will all come out
in the end. As I was saying to you before we started the interviews, one of the things we try to do is to talk to people from across the political spectrum who may not be conventional for the position that they occupy. So we've had a lot of lefty Brexiteers on the show, and you are a right of centre Remainer. So tell us what that's like at the moment.
Well, I'm not a far right person.
Get that out there, yeah. You're not Tommy Robinson. No. Fantastic.
I'm right of centre, and there are actually an awful lot of right of centre people in Britain who don't like the idea of leaving the European Union. We are the kind of forgotten people there, and there are millions of us. 3 million people voted Conservative who also voted to remain. So I don't feel lonely in any way, but I do feel I'm speaking up for a section of the British electorate that has not really been heard.
And that's why we wanted to have you on the show. So what is the right of centre argument against Brexit?
It's basically conservatism with a small c. Leave things alone unless there's something terribly wrong with them. We've been in the European Union since, when is it, 1974, three, I can't remember. Our economy has been growing fast in recent years alongside the economies of the rest of the European Union. We're still in control of our own destiny. The European Union's project for a sort of European superstate is more or less dead now. I'm not convinced the European Union has a secure future, but let's just leave well enough alone. I'm quite sure we have an insecure future outside the EU. So what I can't do, and lots of my Leave readers are always hitting me with this question, you know, why? You said why you don't want to leave, but what's so great about the European Union? Tell us what you believe in, because we believe in something. We believe in independence. We believe in taking back control. We believe in a separate destiny for the United Kingdom. What do you believe in about Europe? I don't believe in anything about Europe. I just believe that it's chugging along okay, and we're okay. And to take this mad step into oblivion, as for all we know, it's just a very stupid thing to do. It's always hard to be the skeptical one, the one who thinks, let's not do this, when there isn't anything else in particular that you do want to do. But I say, let's not do this.
Now, people always talk about no deal, and they always use terms like crashing out and all the rest of it. And I still don't know, what would no deal mean for this country if on the 31st of October we decide to leave without a deal? What are the long-term implications of that?
Well, the immediate consequence of leaving without a deal is that we would then have to negotiate a deal, because we have to have an arrangement with all the countries around us of one kind or another. So any idea that we're not going to have a deal is for the birds. The only question is, do we try and get a satisfactory deal before we leave, or do we just leave and then put ourselves in the position of a supplicant to the European Union and try to get the best deal we can? The immediate effect of leaving without a deal would be, I think, a bit of a stock market crash. It would be a substantial depreciation in the value of the pound, and it would be an immediate contraction of our economy. We could weather that. After 4 or 5 years, we would get used to being a country that wasn't in a trading bloc with anybody else. We'd all be a bit poorer and we'd remain a bit poorer. We'd have a bit less influence and we'd remain with a bit less influence. But the sun would continue to rise and set every day and not many people would die. It would just be a bit shit, really.
Well, that's interesting that you're quite moderate on both sides, I would say.
Just to interrupt, that just reminded me so much of one of my parents' evening interviews with my dad taking me along. Sorry, carry on.
There's a triggering moment for Francis right there. But you're quite moderate on it. So I'm curious what you make, because I, as a Remainer, I try not to call myself a Remainer. I voted Remainer. I haven't made it into my identity. I'm struggling to see how this language that you see from people like David Lammy about how everyone who's voted Leave is a Nazi or the ERG are Nazis or worse than Nazis. I don't see how that extremism helps. What do you make of the language that we now use when talking about these things?
I've learnt, sometimes to my cost, I have learnt that you need to be very careful what you say about people who voted Leave. Lots of my friends voted Leave. Lots of very decent people voted Leave. Lots of people who are not racists or xenophobes or anything else voted Leave. On the other hand, quite a lot of people who are racists and are xenophobes also voted Leave. On the whole, I would stand back from trying to characterize Leave voters in the United Kingdom with any overall generalized characterization. They're just 17 million odd different people, each with his or her own story. Where I would go in hard is on the leadership of that campaign and on the politicians. Most of the politicians leading that campaign know that it's going to make us poorer, but have not said so. These are, in the age-old way of politicians, people who are simply capitalizing on the hopes and fears of a large electorate who don't know as much about it as they do. It's a sort of confidence trick. They are building their careers on building up hopes and building up fears that the hopes they know will not be justified, and the fears are groundless. So I dislike and am prepared to vilify the leadership of the Leave campaign. But as for the voters themselves, they are as many and various as are all around us.
So you're saying, so in particular, what would your specific criticisms be of a figure like Nigel Farage? Because on the one hand, you could say that in many ways, one of the most talented politicians of his generation with what he's achieved.
Well, if by talent you mean the ability to whip the mob up and get them on your side, yes, he's talented. I could name you a lot of other politicians through history who were talented in that sense. But he's the man behind the Breaking Point poster, do you remember, which suggested hordes of people who are definitely not white trying to get into the United Kingdom. What is that if it's not whipping up popular fears? He's one of the people that pretended that Turkey was likely to join the European Union in the foreseeable future. He knows that isn't true. It isn't difficult to get votes by making people afraid of other people. And I have neither sympathy nor even grudging admiration for people who do that.
Well, let me put the counterpoint to you on that, because a lot of the people that we've spoken to, many academics, experts, some people from the left, some people from the right, one of the things they've talked about is that the Brexit vote was to some extent driven by people's concerns about immigration, which I would argue as an immigrant in this country were quite legitimate given the labor boom that we saw in immigration and given the fact that while we are in the EU, we cannot control that part of our destiny. You said we control our destiny, but that is a part of our destiny that we absolutely do not control. Right? We do not control the number of people who come here or who comes here.
No.
We don't have any control over that. You know, when I came to this country in 1995, like 3% of the British public thought immigration was a major issue. By the mid, tens?
Yeah.
By the mid-tens. It's a weird name. By the mid-tens, it was almost 50% because the numbers of people.
Something had happened, right?
Yeah. So you could argue that Nigel Farage, rather than whipping up the mob, he was responding to the concerns of ordinary people about the levels of immigration, which were not being heard in Westminster at the time. I think that's fair to say, isn't it?
Yeah. The difference between whipping up and responding is actually rather a nuanced thing, because we are all in echo chambers, and you can amplify and re-echo to people what you hear from them, or you can try and explain the true position. But you are absolutely right that there was widespread anxiety about the numbers of people coming to Britain. Perhaps the then Labour government should have taken the option that was open to them to control the numbers coming from the EU. On the other hand, those people who did exploit those fears, and there is also incipient racism, which I shall not allow you to overlook, people who did exploit those fears knew very well that probably the bulk of the immigrants that we have and are getting, we need. And that even after taking back control, we probably wouldn't enormously reduce the number of immigrants coming here. But as I say, I won't let you get away with the idea that concern about immigration has nothing to do with racism. It does. All across the part of England that was my constituency, the beautiful Derbyshire Dales in the Peak District, there are almost nobody but white people there. In fact, I remember canvassing on the doorstep, a man in a very, very leafy sort of suburb who was worried. He said, black people are flooding into this country. They're all over the place. They're everywhere. I said, well, I don't think there's any black people actually around here. And he said, there's one in Froggatt, Froggatt being a place nearby.
Yeah.
That isn't the same as concern about immigration. And I have to say that if this immigration had been coming from the United States or Canada or white Australia, you wouldn't have had the anxiety or anger about it that you did. There is a streak of racism in all of us. And there's a very strong streak of racism in the British people, as there is in almost every people.
Hey, I'm Russian. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually, I would say to you that, well, I think you're right that broadly speaking, everyone has everyone can be potentially racist. This is one of the most open, tolerant and welcoming countries in the world, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it's not always a very competitive field, then, is it?
Well, certainly not when my country is involved. But I just want to explore this point a little bit, because I understand what you say.
Yeah.
I think it's undoubtedly true that there are some people who are racist, and some of those people would have voted Leave on the basis that it would stop black people coming to your constituency, even though black people don't come from the EU. But anyway, there may have been people like that, right?
Yeah, but some of those Bulgarians are quite sun-tanned.
like me. Yeah,
it's like
they look
you.
Like me.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't consider myself black necessarily, but it's 2019. Maybe I should come out as black next year.
Yeah, you can identify as it. Why not?
Why not, right? But on the immigration point, the angle that I'm getting at is, the mainstream politicians were not listening to people about immigration. And anyone who, I remember this very well, anyone in the mid-10s, as I keep awkwardly saying, who expressed any concern about immigration was immediately dismissed as being racist, which I think is an unfair conflation. You can be for different levels of immigration without hating the people who are coming. You may feel that it's hampering integration in this country. You may feel that it's hampering community cohesion in this country. You may just feel like we've had a lot of immigration. It's time to let everybody kind of settle down, and then we can open up the door again. So if ordinary people aren't listening, if ordinary politicians in the mainstream aren't listening, is it not the job of someone like Nigel Farage to come along and upset things, upset the apple cart, because ordinary people aren't having their voices heard?
Well, you can hear people's voices. That's one thing. And you can do what they ask you to do, and that's another. And we all did hear the voices of people who felt that immigration was too high. And David Cameron certainly heard those voices. And when he went for his renegotiation with the EU, he tried really hard to get some kind of break on immigration. And you can blame Angela Merkel. I could blame Angela Merkel for not giving him something on that, because she should have, the EU should have, and that might have stopped all this fuss. But in the end, we can talk, as the media do constantly and as politicians do constantly, talk about listening to people, which is one thing. But in the end, we have to talk about what it is that they're saying, whether they're right and whether we want to do what they're asking us, which is why I am a qualified believer in democracy, but I think it can have some very undesirable outcomes. I mean, the whole population might be saying we want to go to the moon, and politicians might say, sorry, but that's not on. Then you would say, but you're not listening to the people. You're not listening to them. They're saying they want to go to the moon. You're not listening. I am listening. I hear they want to go to the moon. Unfortunately, it is not feasible. You've got to be honest with people.
And so we're in this situation right now where it's political chaos, I think it's fair to say.
Yes.
Where we're at a crisis point. What do we need to do? How can we possibly solve this? What are the options?
Well, if you want a very general, long-term answer, I think we've probably got to smash the two-party system because both the parties that we've got are making a terrific mess of it. And I don't quite see how the Labour Party is going to come back from this. And I certainly don't see how my own party, the Conservative Party, is going to come back from it. And for that, we might have to move from a first-past-the-post system to something more proportional, which gave smaller chances a chance to breathe. But in the immediate, well, what we got to do is stop Brexit. I still think we can, and I still think there's a decent chance that we will.
But what do you mean by stopping Brexit? I mean, and also, how would you achieve that? Is it by a second referendum?
Yes. Yeah, it would be by a second referendum. It's got to be by a second referendum. You can say, as Jeremy Corbyn does, it's got to be or should be by a general election. Fine, have a general election. But in the end, I want a government that wants us to leave. And I don't think any government... I want a government that wants us to stay. And I don't...
Something slipped out there, Matthew. Something. That'll be the clip that we use. We're just going to take that 3 seconds and put it out on the internet. Yeah. And that will define your career.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Matthew Paris has his turnaround moment. That'll be the slogan.
Yeah. I did an interview with The Spectator ages ago, a podcast. And someone said, so you're saying we're all racists, everyone's racist, are you? And I said, yes. And from now on, all the people that troll me on online commentary say, Matthew Paris believes we're all racist. Anyway, I want a government that keeps us in the European Union. I don't think any government could or should do that without getting endorsement from the people. I want a second referendum, therefore, because we've had a referendum. It said leave. And if we're not to leave, we got to ask the people their permission to change our minds.
What if they don't give it?
Then we leave. I mean, every nation has a right to self-harm. I think my argument would be that when we said leave, as by a slim majority, I don't think we had really thought through or knew or been informed of just what that was going to mean and how difficult it was going to prove. We have been informed of that. We do know. If we still say leave, if we still say, well, we're prepared to crash out without a deal and take our chances, it is a democracy. We just have to accept that.
And what would you say to those people who say what you are wishing to do with a second referendum is undemocratic and you're essentially ignoring my voice simply because it is not palatable or mainstream?
Well, I would say I'm not ignoring your voice. You can vote in the second referendum and let's see how many people vote how many ways. If you take a single snapshot of public opinion in 2016, it won't be long until that's 4 years ago. Mm. You can't then say you can never go against that snapshot. Opinions change. Mm.
And do you think it's going to change as well, depending on who the Conservative Party elect to be their leader? Do you think in terms of Boris Johnson and Jeremy Hunt?
I should just say that we're recording this a couple of weeks before the outcome, but the video, as you know, will go out the day before.
Yeah.
Yes.
So as people are watching it, we already know, or they already know, we don't know now. Yeah. What do you make of the leadership candidates?
Well, I'm not absolutely certain it's going to be Boris Johnson. Mm. I think it's the overwhelming likelihood is it will be Boris Johnson. But I do know the ordinary membership of the Conservative Party, the activists of whom I am one, the least active activist in the world. And I know that they adore Boris. I know that they love hearing him speak. I know that you can sell out any dinner with a ticket that includes an after-dinner speech by Boris. But I do know also that there's hardly a Conservative member in the country who doesn't harbour a little bit of a doubt about whether he has the competence, the concentration, the command of detail, and the personal trustworthiness to be prime minister. And it may be that by the time you hear this, that seed of doubt may have grown. And I think Jeremy Hunt, well, he's not mad, so he has a chance. But say it's Boris. Well, we've got to stop him. We've got to stop him leaving the taking us out of the European Union without at least letting Parliament vote on it. And I believe they would vote not to.
So how do you stop someone like Boris?
Well, a vote of no confidence in the government. If there's time before the 31st of October, it's not clear there is, but there might be. Or there are various legislative measures you can vote for that would actually stop a government taking us out. But Parliament's got to have the final say on this.
When I read an article by you a couple of weeks ago where you were talking about no deal, and what I found quite surprising is that you seemed almost resigned to your fate at that point, and you were saying, I don't think we're going to be able to avoid a no deal, but I'm hearing you speak now and you seem quite positive about it. What's changed?
I wasn't quite saying that, but I was saying it's not looking good. It's looking as though Boris Johnson could take us out of the European Union without a deal. I could see it happening, and I'm alarmed about it. So to express alarm is not quite the same thing as to express despair. I don't yet despair, but I am alarmed. It really could happen. I think there's a 30, 40, 50% chance that it's going to happen now. And as a result, far from hanging our heads and weeping, we have to fight all the harder.
The question I was going to ask, coming back to the democratic point, and I think it's an important one. As I say, we've talked to, and I talked to a lot of people who voted Remain, but also a lot of people who voted Leave. And what they would be saying is, if you were sitting there now and we had voted to Remain 3 years ago, would you be as open to the idea of a second referendum as you are now?
That's a very, very sharp question. Firstly, if we had narrowly voted to remain, I have absolutely no doubt that the Leave people wouldn't simply have packed their bags and gone home. They would be agitating. They might be agitating immediately for another referendum, or they might be digging in for the long haul, as it were, and prepared to push for it in 5, 10, 15 years' time.
Like the SNP did in Scotland,
yes.
Essentially.
Yes. And what would I say if there was A, evidence that the European Union that we'd stayed in was not the European Union that we thought we were staying in, just as I would say that the terms of our departure are not the terms of departure we thought we were going to get. What would I say if public opinion in Britain had swung fairly decisively against remaining in the European Union? I think I would find it hard to resist the demand for another referendum.
That's interesting. You say the opinion has swung. I wasn't aware that it had. Has opinion swung towards Remain?
Yes, but it might be 52-48 the other way. Perhaps 55-45 the other way.
But also pollsters haven't necessarily covered themselves in glory in recent...
They haven't. But what we do know is this, and I don't mean this in an unkind way, but Leavers are dying all the time. Leavers are much older than Remainers on balance, and so the actual composition of the electoral base is changing, and I think has changed.
And how much responsibility does the Conservative government and the Conservative Party have to take for this whole debacle? Because part of me cynically thinks it was just a desperate attempt to save their own skin, really, wasn't it? And to keep the party together.
They have to take complete responsibility for this debacle. The Labour Party would never have done it. It's all the Conservative Party's fault. It's not so much a crime of selfishness or self-preservation. It's a crime of miscalculation. David Cameron wanted to dish the Leavers, and he felt that a renegotiation followed by a referendum would almost certainly result in a national vote to remain. So he was using a referendum as a weapon to clobber his opponents. If his calculation had proved right, as it did in Scotland, for instance, with their referendum, we would all be saying, oh, what a shrewd politician he was. But the lesson I draw from this, the mistake he made, anyone can miscalculate, he did. George Osborne didn't. George Osborne didn't want a referendum. You can miscalculate, but you should never use a referendum to achieve a result that you want unless you are prepared to run with the possibility that you don't get it. And the truth is that those who call this referendum believe that our membership of the European Union was extremely important to us, and that leaving the European Union would be a very bad thing for the British people. Then they shouldn't have called a referendum, because the British people might have opted for the very thing that they thought was very bad. You should never offer people a choice or give people the opportunity to take a course that you think would be a disaster. It's irresponsible.
So you Peter Hitchens described how much, when he came to do our show, how much he hated referendum. He called them nasty, dirty little things.
Margaret Thatcher used slightly politer language, but she hated referendums too.
Mm. I was going to ask, you're someone who's on the outside of the political world now as a journalist, but you are a former MP. How do you feel? Would you rather be in there in the trenches stirring the pot from the inside, or are you happier being on the outside and lobbing grenades in from the outside?
I sometimes feel that it's we of the media who are in the trenches lobbing the grenades, and the poor bloody infantry are actually the MPs who are really just being exploded with grenades landing all around them and are dazed. And miserable, and in some cases almost suicidal, and don't know what to do. So I'd rather be lobbing the grenades as we are. But to answer your question perhaps slightly more seriously, ever since I left Parliament, ceased to be an MP, I have found that whatever voice I have gets a bigger audience and has more influence than it did when I was a backbench MP. I don't think any cabinet minister ever invited me to dinner when I was a backbench Tory MP. When you're a columnist in a national newspaper, you get those invitations all the time.
That's fascinating, isn't it? So do you think that essentially Parliament has little influence now because of this, in terms of how this goes, or will it still have a big role to play?
Well, I think the ordinary backbencher has always been a creature who's importance is exaggerated by the general public and has never had a huge amount of power, and only ever gets very much power when there's a very fine balance between the two parties and a rebellion on one side or the other can shift the dial. But they do have that power now, backbenchers, and I wish they would use it. Some of them are. There are some very brave people out there, on both sides actually, some very brave people, but too many of them are just kind of covering their heads while the shells land.
In many ways, though, you can't blame them, because if you are a Remain MP and that's what you believe is best for this country, and your constituency voted Leave, I mean, you're in a horrible situation.
You're in a very simple situation. You're going to lose your job. So you have to be really brave to do that. I agree. A huge courage is called for, and some have shown it. David Gawke, The Justice Secretary, showed it and was challenged in his constituency, but luckily survived. Dominic Grieve has been challenged. So far, he has survived. Plenty of others know very well that they're not going to be re-selected because their Leave constituency associations disapprove of having a Remain MP. Yeah, it takes guts.
Well, I listened to this, sorry, Francis, with the Leaver hat on, because we've been talking to a lot of Leavers, and I can hear exactly what they would be saying now, which is, look, we elect these people to represent us. How is it that you're sitting here as a former MP and saying basically the MP should ignore the will of his constituency and show courage by doing the opposite of what they want?
MPs are not delegates. They are not presented with a list of things that their constituents want them to do, voted in on the basis of their promising to do those things, and then absolutely obliged to do those things. I think the things that you have in your manifesto, the things which your party has promised, you have a solemn duty to look very hard and do your best to achieve what people want. But if you come to the conclusion that it can't be done, or that it can't be done without grave damage to the very people who have sent you there, then your final responsibility is to your own judgment and to your own conscience. We have a system of representative democracy, not of mandated manifesto commitments.
Well, to me, that sounds like a very strong argument for a general election now, because we have two parties that ran on leaving the EU, neither of which seems to be prepared to implement that. So should we not have a general election to elect a new parliament of people who better represent the public's wishes?
I think there's a very strong argument for a general election. Basically, the government's completely buggered. they can't do anything. They're stuck.
That's a technical term, I take it. Yeah.
But do you know what this reminds me of, watching Labour and Conservatives? I'm a West Ham fan, and sometimes we play at another team, and we're both teams on the pitch are absolutely crap. And you just thought, I think yes. We should just knock this on the head, because yes. You're both yeah. useless.
Yes.
And it's come to the point, I mean, how much responsibility do Labour have to take? They have an open goal against this government in every possible way, and they still can't seem to capitalise on it.
Because their leader doesn't want to remain. Mm. Jeremy Corbyn has always hated the European Union. If you're a proper Marxist, you ought to hate the European Union. It is a capitalist club. He's absolutely right about that. Mm. And so right at the very top, Jeremy Corbyn, I think Seamus Milne, who's an extremely powerful right-hand person, there's a little group there who, A, would like Britain not to be in the European Union. So when we have, as they believe, a socialist government, it'll be free to do the socialist things the EU wouldn't let it. And B, don't want to be blamed for the pain that would cause. Well, then it's perfect, isn't it? Get the Tories to take us out, blame the Tories, but we're out, and that's what a Marxist would want. Mm.
So do you think he wants a general election, or would he prefer us to leave and then trigger it?
I think if you're 70, you probably want a general election as quickly as possible. Yeah. But I do think the result of that general election might be devastating, both for the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, and I just don't care anymore. I think probably devastation would be the beginning of reconstruction.
I think that is so true, and I think you speak for a lot of people when you say that. I think there's so many people now who are so fed up of the two-party system because it doesn't represent what the people want. And I think devastation is the right word, because what you likely end up with, certainly, is a large Brexit Party block in Parliament. The Conservatives and Labour would lose quite a lot of votes to them, and the Greens might get a few seats, and you might get the Lib Dems might be making
yes.
a resurgence,
yeah.
right? If we were to have a general election in the next 6 months, I mean, it's hard, obviously, to make these predictions because we don't even know who the leader of the Tory Party is going to be. But what do you think would happen? That devastation that you talk about, what would it look like?
I don't know. I think it's the socialist thinker, Marxist philosopher Gramsci, who said that the old is dying, but the new is struggling to be born. And I think the new is struggling to be born. Look at the poor old Tiggers, the independent group, for instance. It was a bit of a stillbirth, that one. So I don't know what the consequence would be, but I think it probably would be the fragmentation of the two-party system that we have at the moment. And it is literally pointless to try to predict how that fragmentation would then pan out. But I think this thought is worth putting across. The next general election will not be a matter of whether YouGov is saying that this party is on 28%, this is on 26%, this is 19%, oh, the Tories have gone up to 32%. It won't be that sort of an election. It will be an election in which no one party predominates and no one party challenges. And in a first-past-the-post system such as we have, parties may get in on tiny votes, as the Labour Party just did squeak through the lowest vote in history, I think, in the Peterborough by-election. It will all be about electoral pacts. It will all be about tactical voting. It will all be about constituency by constituency, which party can split the vote of which other party. And in those circumstances, us pontificating or philosophizing over the overall result is futile.
Guys, we wanted to take a moment just to say thank you to every single one of you who has supported us on Patreon, who sent us money through PayPal. We genuinely could not do the show without you. Having said that, we've now also found a corporate sponsor to sell out to.
Absolutely, and it is the magazine The Week. And The Week is a news filter that pulls together the best articles from over 200 different sources, from publications such as The Telegraph, The FT, or for our one liberal snowflake fan, The Guardian.
Exactly. And that's what they do. They do exactly what we do on the show, which is pull together information from different sides of the debate, the left and the right, so you don't find yourself stuck in an echo chamber and you can make your own mind up.
And if you want to make the most of this offer, visit theweek.co.uk/offer and use our special code, which is Trigger, for your 6 free issues of The Week.
What The Week does is it allows you to read less and know more, which is going to appeal to people like Francis, who can barely read.
Absolutely. And it's not just news as well. It's also sports. So if you're interested in football and you want to find out the latest details of the transfer window, they will have that in there as well, which won't appeal to Constantine because he's a virgin.
But seriously, guys, we know that you've got busy lives. You're not going to be reading 200 articles a day. And what The Week does is combine all those things in one easy package that you can look at once a week and know what's going on.
Join thousands that trust The Week as their essential curated news source. Try it for yourself with your first 6 issues completely free.
To take advantage of this great offer, visit theweek.co.uk/offer. Enter our special code, which is, of course, Trigger, and you will get your first 6 issues of The Week completely free.
Now, so we've talked a lot about Brexit and the European Union. Someone made a very, very good point that one of the problems with Brexit is it stopped us from discussing other matters, which are equally, if not more important. The Conservative Party has always marketed itself as a party of law and order. We will, you know, invest in police, we'll have a strong police presence. I still teach in East London, and knife crime is out of control. How much responsibility do the Conservative Party have to take for this?
I agree that law and order is important, and I agree your characterisation of the Conservative Party's stance. I don't think that simply paying police officers more or recruiting a lot more officers on the beat is the answer to the problem. I think the problem is one that any government, but particularly a Conservative government, is going to find difficult to tackle. I think there is a problem in the underlying competence of the British police force or forces. I don't think we should have so many constabularies. I think we should have a national police force. I think we should have a separate police force for dealing with internet crime, as we do, for instance, with the transport police. I think we should look at the way we recruit police officers. Some should be paid more. Some should be paid less. It should be easier to fail as a police officer and to lose your job as a police officer. A huge problem of reforming, a huge campaign, a project of reforming our national police force should be a priority of any government. But I think the Conservative Party will tend just to slip into the old tropes of we need more bobbies on the beat, we need another 2,000 policemen by next July or whatever, and it won't make any difference. On knife crime, I think knife crime is a kind of fad. It's a kind of fashion. Now, it sounds, I know, cruel. It sounds as though I'm trying to diminish the horror of knife crime. I'm not. The horror is, I don't need to explain the horror. It's very real to everybody. But things do go in fashions, including horrible things go in fashions. And it is at the moment a bit like a virus, a bit like a disease sweeping through certain kinds of younger people. And I'm not sure that simply flooding the streets with police officers is necessarily going to make much of a difference. I know it sounds feeble to say what we need is education, but what we do need to do is talk to people, talk to younger people, try to communicate, try to engage, and try to persuade. I'm not sure that law and order alone will solve this.
Well, we've had different people on the show to talk about knife crime. One of them is Dr. Tony Sowell, who does a lot of work and in that area and bringing young kids from those backgrounds through to apply to Oxford and Cambridge, etc. Mm. And one of the points he made was about the breakdown of the family. There's not enough fathers in the home to to teach young men, young boys, the way of the world, essentially. So that's one aspect of it. But you could argue, I mean, Peter Hitchens made this point on our show, and I find it very persuasive, that it's also about police tactics. If you have the situation we have now, I remember when I first came to this country 20 or more than 20 years ago, it was a common occurrence that you'd be walking down the street and there would be a police officer walking towards you who was just patrolling the street. They were just on the street, walking around, creating a visual deterrent to crime. I probably haven't seen a police officer doing that in years. You see police officers going to a crime scene, going from a crime scene, but the idea that you're just walking down the street in your town and you see a bobby on the beat, I don't think that happens anymore, does it?
As I understand it, beat policing is not something that the great majority of police officers want to end up doing for much of their lives. And it isn't always just the government or the Home Secretary. It is something sometimes the police themselves who prefer to be in panda cars than on the beat. Nevertheless, the police do have an argument, which I think we ought to take seriously, which is we could never have so many police officers that their visibility would be almost everywhere, cooling and calming and discouraging crime. That the numbers involved would be too great. We can find places which are hotspots and make sure there are police officers there, but I'm not sure that numbers of visible policemen these days is most of the answer.
And how much of the responsibility, again, do the Conservative Party need to take with austerity, with the cuts coming in, and particularly the cuts to youth workers, the cuts to youth clubs? You know, a lot of people have actually said that this has been one of the prime reasons why there's been a spike.
I was in favour of austerity, and I still am. I think it was necessary. However, I think the government, the Conservative, first the Coalition and then the Conservative government, went for the line of least resistance, the easy target, which is local government. Because you can cut local government, and they have, by, you know, up to 50%. And the immediate effects don't show. And you say, wow, we're giving them 50% less money, and the world carries on, everything's the same. And it takes a while because of things like looking after the elderly, looking after young people, youth groups, all kinds of little things that local government does to try to spot where the problems are and to help. When you begin to draw back from those things, it takes a while for it to show. And it is beginning to show. And I think it's a sign that austerity went too quickly for the soft target.
So what, in particular, what would you have targeted rather than local government? Because a lot of my family work in local government, and they say the cuts have been absolutely devastating to the point where they can only give the very basic of services, and everything else, it's just, you simply can't deliver.
Well, I might have taxed a little bit more, which is a kind of austerity. And I might have held back on pensions increases. Those of retired age in Britain now, which includes me, are no longer the poorest section of the community. We are doing pretty well. I came here with my freedom pass, my London freedom pass, elbowing aside younger people or unemployed people. I'm probably earning 10 times what they're earning.
So typical Tory.
Exactly so.
So why were you in favour of austerity? Because I don't think that's an argument that gets heard very much. Why was it necessary? And why were you in favour?
We were living beyond our means, and you can't live beyond your means forever.
And how do you, in particular, what was it? Could you pinpoint something, that an example of how we were living beyond our means, how we were spending far too much?
Well, if you're spending more than you're earning, you could look at any item of your expenditure and see that it would need to be reined back. And I mentioned pensions as one example.
And Francis is from Venezuela. He's not very good with spending and saving. So it was necessary because we were spending beyond. That is an argument that I absolutely get. To be honest with you, I think that's, look at our deficit, look at our national debt is crazy.
Yeah. And look now at the promises that the Tory leadership candidates have been making. They seem to have completely forgotten what I thought was a core Conservative philosophy, that we should live within our means.
And so what are they promising? Sorry, Francis. What is it that you're concerned about in terms of their...
Well, Boris has been talking about tax cuts for the top level, raising the threshold. Mm. He's been talking about more money on education. He's been talking about more money for the police. Jeremy Hunt, I can't remember how many things Jeremy Hunt has probably spent a lot more on defence, for instance. I mean, all these are good things. But you can't just will good things without willing the means to pay for the good things.
Well, you've had your bash at Boris. What do you make of Jeremy Hunt, just in case he gets elected tomorrow when this video
I don't think he exists. I think he's a hologram. I long to just put my hand and see if it goes right through him. I don't feel there's a real person there. I suppose I'd have to vote for him because he's neither mad, nor wicked, nor stupid. He's a focused individual, a good manager, as far as I can see. But where's the personality? Where's the where's the sense of core values, of principle? He seems to shift every time the wind shifts.
I was about to say, if you want personality, vote Boris, but then you started talking about values, and I was like, maybe not.
Wrong personality.
Wrong person.
I didn't say any personality.
But it's interesting to me that you say that, because I think it shows to what extent politics, and particularly choosing a leader of a party or a leader of a country, is such a visceral, animalistic thing almost. Because I didn't know much about Jeremy Hunt. And then I watched the hustings, and he had this little video talking about his career, people talking about what he'd done for them, how he created this business. And then he's actually had a very accomplished career. He's someone who's created a lot. He's started companies. You know, he took care of one of the most difficult departments to manage in government, in health. And of course, many people criticize him for it, but also he did some good things in that. And yet you look at him and you go, well, you're just a bit bland. And that is enough to condemn someone to essentially not be prime ministerial.
Yes, but you could talk to people at the top of many of our service industries, in the media, public relations, all those things, and you will find plenty of Jeremy Hunt-like characters who have done very well and who have worked their way to the top by being bland. He's a smooth operator. He's definitely a smooth operator, and it will get you so far in politics being a smooth operator. And he's a hard worker, a very hard worker, and I went to talk to him about health once when he was health secretary, and I was impressed at the grip, the intellectual grip he has on the whole thing. But these are managerial skills, and you need managerial skills. Boris has no managerial skills, but you need something more than managerial skills, and I'm not convinced that he has them. But we may see. Maybe there's a new butterfly. Jeremy Hunt is going to emerge from the chrysalis.
Isn't there something to be said, though, that we've done personality politics to death? You know, we've elected somebody who is, you know, he's charismatic or whatever else. Ultimately, what we need now is somebody who can just get the job done. And if that is the case, we have to be pragmatic, and we have to just say, you know, Boris, great, he'll make you laugh. You know, if he's a comedian, you get him to close the comedy store and, you know, to have you rolling in the aisles, applause breaks, all the rest of it. But if you want someone to get the job done and be consistent, you don't want a comedian.
I don't disagree with you. The first thing that we've got to have is someone who can get things done. I'm a great believer in the values of public administration, sound public administration. Politicians talk about vision, they talk about change, they talk about being the change, walking the walk, all this kind of crap. they forget that the first thing you have to do is run an extremely complicated state. It's like being the governor of a colony. You have to run things. And I think probably Jeremy Hunt does have those abilities, but I've suggested that in order to keep people with you, to keep a nation with you, especially through difficult times, you need something more than that, something in addition to that.
And just going back to Theresa May, because there was a part of me, I've never voted Conservative in my life, and you know, but there was a part of me that felt, in the end, quite sorry for her. How bad a job did she do?
She did a really bad job. And you shouldn't feel sorry for her. I know it's all, once people are down, you don't want to kick them. But she, what her big failure was to explain both to her own party and to the British people just how difficult what it was we were trying to do, which was leave the European Union, was going to be. And instead, she went storming in at the beginning with all these red lines and promises. And all that was red meat to the irresponsible right in her own party. And it all ran away with her.
Well, Matthew, on that optimistic note, we've got time for one more question, which is the question that we always ask, which is, what is the one thing that no one is talking about that we ought to be talking about?
There was a feminist called, I think, Valerie Solana, who said, the only purpose of men is to produce sperm. Fortunately, we have sperm banks. My great fear is that...
I'll be honest with you, Matthew, I didn't see this coming.
Radical feminists are known for their logic and intelligence.
Future generations will notice what the animal world noticed a long time ago, which is that you don't need many males. Just enough males to fight with each other to sort of keep evolution going, but you don't need nearly as many males as you do females. And women haven't noticed this. All women really would need would be a sperm bank and sex toys. They don't need us, and we certainly don't need a population which is 50% male. So we're having a marvelous time because no one has noticed that we're unnecessary.
There you go, mate. I think one of us is going to have to go. We're unnecessary, that's it. Shall we flip a coin?
Yeah, well, that's why I make the tea. Okay.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it. You're on Twitter at...
I'm not.
You're not on Twitter?
I follow Twitter. I'm on it, but I never tweet.
Oh, okay.
I don't trust myself.
You don't trust yourself. Well, you don't follow Matthew on Twitter, then just read his column. It's always very interesting. Follow us on Twitter. We are on Twitter. We still feel like we're necessary somewhat. So follow us at TriggerPod on all the social media. And subscribe to the YouTube channel. As always, click the bell button next to the subscribe button. And we will see you in a week from now.
And yes, and you always forget.
No, it's fine, man.
Are you sure?
Yeah, it's fine.
He's got
I'm going to sell out my show in Edinburgh anyway. It's called All Well That Ends Well. I've sold a lot of tickets already. But if you want to come, please do.
Hurry up.
Exactly.
Okay.
That is a great marketing move. I haven't sold any tickets.
No, he really hasn't. Seriously, buy a ticket. I know, I've seen the sales. Anyway, if you want to come and see me, I'm at the Bill Murray Comedy Club in Angel in August and July. Check out the website for details. If you enjoy the show, please share it. Please tell a friend. Leave us a nice review on iTunes. It's particularly if you're in the United States or abroad, because that helps us get global coverage. And that is pretty much it. Thank you so much for watching and listening, and we will see you next week. Bye-bye. Before you go, consider joining our exclusive member feed. As a member, you'll get ad-free and extended interviews.
Click the membership link in the podcast description or find the exclusive episodes link on your podcast listening app to join us.